Inside Sources.
Inside Sources.
America's voice of reason. Boyd Matheson.
On Utah's home for elevated conversation.
Inside Sources on KSL News Radio.
If you tune into national media today, you'll think most of the country is carefully and breathlessly watching the latest from the early proceedings in the trial of former President Donald Trump as it begins and jury selection gets underway in New York. This is day two. But beyond the headlines of everyone being there, and actually I think no one is there except for the media at this point in the program, the question is what impact, if any, will this have on the 2024 election? Let's begin.
Think you know the news of the day? Think again with Boyd Matheson on KSL News Radio.
Well, if you did tune into any of the major national news networks today, you would think that the only thing happening in the world is the trial that is underway. Jury selection is underway in New York in the case against former President Donald Trump in a hush money payment case. And as you look at that, we're not going to dive into any of those pieces of the puzzle. I want to start with the fact that we have to think again about that because that is not the news of the day for most Americans in most places, let alone the rest of the world. So the reality is about 20% of the country is even following the case in New York at all. Most Americans have tuned it out. So there's a few that are watching, and I would guess that the few that are watching are either those that are firmly, deeply rooted in the former president's camp, and those who are on the other end of the spectrum and are completely running against and making sure everything gets in the way of the former president becoming the president again. I think that's where that 20% of the country is made up. Everyone else got up and went to work today. Everyone else got up and day after tax day did a reassessment of the finances around the kitchen table. And so most Americans are not tuned into this. Will it have an impact on 2024? I think it will in the end. I don't think anything that takes place over the next 6 weeks is going to be a big game changer in terms of either the current president or the former president, because most people aren't watching and they're just not that tuned in. Now, should the former president be convicted, then the dynamics shift a little bit, not in a big way. They shift a little bit in a few key spaces. So often we try to look at voters as a monolithic group that march in lockstep. It just isn't the case. And so there will be a group of voters that will say, oh, he's being targeted. That pushes them into the Trump tent just a little bit more. And there will be many who will say, okay, he's been convicted. That pushes me out of the Trump tent and into the Biden camp or a third party. And so all of those are the things that I think are most likely to happen. It will be very small slivers of the voting public that will be swayed by this particular trial. The rest of the trials against the former president will, none of them are expected to see the light of day until we get into 2025. They've all been either pushed back or delayed, or they've gone through different motions. And none of those, I think, will have a real significant impact on what happens here in 2024. So let's start with the only little bit we're going to hit about what's going on, and that is earlier today, the former president gave some comments, as he is prone to do, walking in and coming out. He was walking in to day two of jury selection, saying he would rather be campaigning than in New York.
I should be right now in Pennsylvania, in Florida, in many other states, North Carolina, Georgia, campaigning. This is all coming from the Biden White House. They're using this in order to try and win an election, and it's not working that way. It's working the opposite way. Voters understand it. All you have to do is look at the polls. This is a shame trial.
So very much on message there for the former president. It is a grievance. This is a political maneuver, according to the former president. It's preventing him from campaigning. So he's trying to tie all of that together and to reinforce what he's been saying for a long time. None of that was new. That is part of the message. And I think part of what the former president has been doing has been just establishing this, not only a grievance message, but it's also a victim message. And so you combine victimhood with a populist bent, a grievance populist bent, you end up with something that sounds like this is all a witch hunt. They're out to get me. And if they get me, they're coming after you. And that's kind of the strain that the former president has been using, both in his big public rallies as well as his social media communication. And he just reinforced that today as he was walking into the courtroom. I have been saying that the most troubling things for those in the former president's campaign sphere is that he has to be in the courtroom for the next 6 to 8 weeks. And that drains the two most priceless commodities to any campaign at any level, time and money. I would also add focus in the midst of that, time, attention, and dollars, because that's what a campaign is made up of. And if the former president is in a courtroom vast majority of the day on most days, he's not out campaigning. The former president is right. He won't be campaigning in Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, Michigan, Nevada, Arizona, North Carolina, because those are going to be tricky. Now, it is interesting that in New York, in this particular court, they do take Wednesday off from court, and then, of course, the weekends. So the president will have 3 days a week from which to play, and then the evenings. He has hinted that he will be doing events in the evening. And so the interesting thing to me there beyond the headlines is that, look, this will continue to drain money. He's spending a lot of campaign cash on legal fees. So that puts him at a disadvantage with current President Trump, current President Biden, former President Trump, as the dollars and cents start to play out. And that will be even more crucial as we get into the fall. The other thing is just the attention. If you're in a courtroom 8 hours a day, you're not working on other strategies. You're not working on other things in terms of a race. And presidential races are grueling. They're grinding. They're very difficult. Anybody who's gone through any kind of campaign at any level knows it's tough stuff. And if you don't have your head in the game, you tend to make mistakes. You tend to get off message. You tend to lash out and do things that end up hurting the campaign rather than helping the campaign. Now, for the current president's perspective and what he's doing, he's, of course, trying to just stay out of the blast zone for most of this. He doesn't have to comment on it. I don't think he will. I think his surrogates will dance around it. They're not going to really lean in either. They really don't need to because, again, most of the country's not watching. I think what you'll see a lot of in terms of what President Biden is focused on, you'll see a lot of what I call Rose Garden campaigning, where he'll have VIPs, business leaders coming to the Rose Garden, or he will take the Rose Garden on the road, where he'll be able to do official business from the White House, and then they'll tack on political events around that. It's a strategy that both Democrats and Republicans have used for decades and decades. Just taking the Rose Garden on the road, give somebody an award, sign a declaration, sign a bill into law, hold a hearing of some sort, and then tack on a whole lot of politics around it. And so that's a way to get around that. And obviously the president has a lot on his plate. And the things that he's going to be challenged with, I think, have far less to do with what is or is not happening in a New York courtroom and the former president. It'll have much more to do for the current president. What happens with inflation? What happens with the economy? And what happens on the world stage in Israel, in Gaza, in Ukraine, in Taiwan, in Russia, China, North Korea? All of those are going to be the things that will be the long game in terms of what happens between now and the first Tuesday of November. We'll be right back.
Think again on Inside Sources with Boyd Matheson. Boyd Matheson divides rage from reason on Inside Sources.
Well, in the From Rage to Reason department, we're on the heels of March Madness, of course, and the coaching carousel that always follows March Madness has been in full cycle, of course, with Coach Pope leaving BYU, heading to the Bluegrass State and the Kentucky Wildcats. And of course, that left BYU with an opening, and the announcement has come that they have made their choice. And so to help us break that down, who that is, and where he comes from and what principles he might bring to the job, we're really pleased to have BYU insider Mitch Harper join us on the line. And Mitch, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks, Boyd. Really appreciate it.
All right, so give us the lowdown. We have an announcement, kind of a big deal in my view.
It is a big hire. It's, you know, Kevin Young, associate head coach of the Phoenix Suns. He's going to be the new head coach, the 16th head coach in BYU basketball history, taking over the shoes left behind by Mark Pope, who obviously took that Kentucky job. And, you know, Kevin Young comes in with extensive background in the NBA, and he's one of the most respected assistant coaches in the NBA. He was the highest paid assistant this past season, $2 million this year with the Suns. X's and O's background, excellent at scheme and creating an offense that players in the NBA today love. So BYU getting him, despite, you know, a limited history of college coaching, it's a fascinating hire, and it's one that on the surface is kind of a newsworthy moment in the basketball world as he goes from the NBA to college.
Yeah, I think that's so interesting. There'll be a lot of things to really track and follow, and I know you'll do the deep dive on all of that in terms of what translates from the NBA back into college. And I want to get to some of the things you mentioned, just how respected he is in the NBA. That is no small thing that he was the highest paid assistant head coach in the league. That speaks volumes, especially at a place like Phoenix, where and everywhere he's been, Philadelphia, some of the other places where strategy has really been king.
No question. And you think about the players that are on the Phoenix Suns roster right now. Kevin Durant, Devin Booker, Bradley Beal, those are NBA superstars. And last year, Kevin Young was a finalist for the Phoenix Suns head coaching job. Mm-hmm. And Devin Booker, one of their stars, was reportedly advocating for Kevin Young to get the job. So to break through and to really relate to professional athletes, I think that bodes well in the effort to, you know, relating to college athletes who, like NBA players, they can get paid now and they have opportunities to make money, not to the level of NBA guys, but, you know, in to some degree, they're like professional athletes. So you have to be able to relate to them and make sure that you can retain a roster. And Kevin Young's done a good job in his time in the NBA, and now he's got the challenge to juggle a college roster, which has so many moving parts.
Yeah, so many moving parts. And you mentioned that name, image, and likeness that these college athletes can now get paid. I think it was one of the areas where if there was criticism about Coach Pope, it was his being a little slow on the uptake in terms of dealing with name, image, and likeness. And I think clearly having someone who understands highly paid athletes in the NBA, that's got to be a benefit and probably a bit of a recruiting tool as well to attract new talent to BYU.
I think so. And I think that, you know, his ability to go into living rooms and say he's been with Joel Embiid with the Sixers and Kevin Durant, I think that'll be fascinating to see how that translates and what that recruiting pitch does for athletes to come to BYU. Because, you know, BYU, despite its limitations, to get an NBA coach that, you know, has been, you know, 15 years in the professional scene in the NBA and the NBA G League, I think it's a fascinating move. And, you know, BYU acted fast. You know, typically these hires at BYU take about 2 weeks, and to get this done in less than a week speaks to how they understand the current climate of college sports and a desire to win at the highest levels in the Big 12.
Yeah, so amazing. And I want to go back to that thing that you mentioned, Mitch, in terms of being in living rooms. I'll never forget sitting in a green room at a speaking event with people like Terry Bradshaw, and you had John Madden. And then you had Lou Holtz, and Lou Holtz had just gone from coaching Notre Dame to coaching South Carolina football that had not had a winning season in I don't know how long. And I asked him, I said, what's the difference between recruiting, sitting in that living room with parents and a young kid, what's the difference recruiting at South Carolina versus recruiting at Notre Dame? And it was so interesting. He said, I love recruiting at South Carolina. I hated it at Notre Dame because kids came to Notre Dame for what Notre Dame was going to do for them. He said, but I can sit in a kid's living room and say, we haven't had a winning season in a decade, but we're on a collision course with the national championship, and I need you. I need you to come be part of this story. And I can kind of see that in Coach Young, that he has a story to tell for these young athletes, both in terms of name, image, and likeness, a great environment at BYU, and maybe that potential of what they could possibly do in the NBA.
Absolutely. And I think that also if he is dealing with recruits that are more business minded and just want to focus on name, image, and likeness opportunities, he can relate to that too by being part of the NBA and it being a downright business. So, you know, in recruiting now, it's interesting too, is that, you know, despite his limitations in recruiting, which he hasn't been a college coach in D1 ever in his coaching career, but you know, recruiting now can be a lot quicker. Gone are the days of recruiting an athlete for 4 or 5 years. Now it could be 2 weeks if it's in the transfer portal and you could get someone added, and you know, just kind of focusing in on how they fit in the depth chart, how they fit on the roster, will the school work for them. It's all sped up now, and so he can play the best of both worlds, I believe, in terms of telling the story and also focusing on the business side as well.
Yeah, fantastic. And final question for you, Mitch, just as you've been talking with your sources and kind of getting that in-depth analysis and perspective, as you've talked to some of those folks, you mentioned Booker kind of advocating for Coach Young. What else are you hearing? If you had to put an early stamp of what's the brand going to be, what's that principle that's going to be the driving force in a Coach Young-led Brigham Young University?
3-point shooting offense, and the brand of this team is going to continue to be a high-powered offense. That's what they were this past year in their first season of the Big 12 with Mark Pope. I would expect that to continue, but I think there'll be more nuance and adapting to the personnel that he builds. And, you know, that's going to be an interesting piece here moving forward, is that he will continue being an assistant coach for the Suns. As long as they go in the NBA playoffs, he'll still be working with identifying his current roster. He's got 7 players on the roster right now, but then also adding players as well. So it's going to be a busy schedule for Kevin Young, but you know, he's going to be someone that his background is offense, and that's where BYU is going to lean towards.
Yeah. And then finally, I want to sneak in one last one because you made me think of something. Often you get an insight into how a leader is going to lead by who they bring along with them. Any early rumblings in terms of assistant coaches or people who might be part of building the culture that Coach Young wants for the Cougars?
A name to keep an eye on will be Chris Burgess, who was linked to the head coaching search to begin with. And, you know, Chris Burgess is currently a Utah Utes assistant coach and played at Utah. That would be someone to monitor because he's got so many connections to the recruiting scene. And you got a, you know, professional head coach in Young, pair him up with someone who knows this market, knows LDS recruiting and the athletes that are LDS that maybe want to be at BYU or are coming up through the ranks. That would be a name to watch, but kind of still in the early stages as with what he could be on his staff, because, you know, as of last night, he was still in the running for the Brooklyn Nets head coaching job. And, you know, KSL Sports sources told us that he even got offered that job and molded over, but backed off, and BYU became the spot for him. So this really moved at light speed and became a reality, because I think many thought on the surface when Pope left, you're not going to get an NBA coach to come to BYU, but BYU committed, and they are making a splash with this hire.
Yeah, definitely making a splash. That's big impact. Big expectations will go along with that as well. Mitch Harper is BYU insider for KSLSports.com, host of the Cougar Tracks podcast, and, of course, Cougar Sports Saturday on KSL News Radio. Mitch, thanks so much for the analysis. Great insight, as always. We'll talk to you soon.
You bet, boy. Take care.
All right. Some great perspective there from Mitch Harper. And as many of you know, I love to watch basketball, college basketball in particular, for the strategy and the structure and the leadership that you see come out. And I think we're going to see a lot of that in the weeks and months ahead. So fascinating look. We'll step aside for bottom of the hour news. Don't go anywhere. Special guest coming up on the program coming up next.
Inside Sources.
Inside Sources.
America's voice of reason. Boyd Matheson.
On Utah's home for elevated conversation.
Inside Sources on KSL News Radio.
Welcome back to Inside Sources here on KSL News Radio. It's great to be with you today. As always, I am Boyd Matheson. Yesterday, we were joined by Curtis Bennett, Executive Director of One Kind Act. Talked about this amazing summit I got to be part of on Friday up at the University of Utah. And we talked about all kinds of people who were doing where we always end the show, go out and do something that makes a difference. And one of those that was celebrated, received an award up at the summit last week, was Jessica Lowe. Jessica is the president and founder of Be A Little Too Kind. So wherever you're sitting, just sit still. This will bring a smile to you. It'll get you to think different and hopefully get you to act different in a number of spaces. And Jessica actually joins us in studio today. Welcome to the show.
Hi, boy. How are you?
I am doing good. You have this extraordinary organization, A Little Too Kind, and I love the backstory to it because it shows what happens when we're aware and then when we're just intentional about things. So give us the story. What is the genesis and what is it that A Little Too Kind is doing?
Okay, so while we started out, I was attending a culinary school, and this was in 2021. And just a few days into the school, I realized that we were going to be making and then throwing away a lot of food. Mm. And the area that my school is located in isn't an area that's heavily saturated with those experiencing homelessness. And so every day when I would leave class, I was thinking, why are we wasting all this food when we could just be giving it to these people who would appreciate it so much? So I started bringing containers from home to pack my food up. And after class, I would just pass it out to anybody that I saw on the way back to my truck. And this kind of grew from just my leftovers to a friend in my class started giving me hers, and then everybody else in the class started donating theirs. And before we know it, we're doing this every single day after class, passing about 20 meals out to people we see on the street.
Oh, I love that. And then, of course, as all great difference makers, you didn't stop.
No.
You just kept looking. So kind of give us the journey from that genesis, which, again, is just being aware, being mindful, seeing people. And seeing an opportunity. Then you went into the space. We talked about this at the summit. I talk about it all the time on this show. You stepped within the parentheses of the crazy idea. Tell us about that.
Yeah. So after school ended, school is a 12-week long program. And so we did that every single day after school. And once school ended, I felt like I couldn't just stop because I had made relationships and formed all of these connections with the homies, that's what we call them. And I started to realize that the whole reason that I had felt so strongly about attending this particular culinary program in the first place was to lead me into this direction. Mm. So I decided to turn it into a nonprofit and focus our efforts fully on food and just make it a lot bigger than what we were doing before. So we started visiting the homies every Thursday. And we bring them a hot homemade meal as well as a sack lunch for later. The hot homemade meal is made by me every week. And we're serving about 120 homies every Thursday. And then everything in the sack lunch is donated by volunteers every single week.
Wow. That is amazing. I just have to go back to something you said, Jessica.
Okay.
That culinary school.
Yeah.
Led you to feeding the homeless.
Yeah.
I don't think that was on the flight plan.
It wasn't. But you know what? Food is magical like that. Sitting down with people and sharing food is magical. And it starts conversations and it opens doors. Yeah. And it opens doors to conversations with people that you might not ordinarily have. And once you have those doors open, then the sky's the limit. That's where a relationship can begin. Mm. And that's what we're doing with our homies is it begins with food, but that's not where it ends.
Yeah.
We are creating relationships with them because they can get food. There's a million different organizations that offer food.
Yeah.
But we're creating relationships with them. And we know their families. We know their stories. And we truly love them like they're our own family.
That's so powerful. And I just want to pause for our listeners. So this is what leadership sounds like. This is what leadership acts like, because it's not about a transaction. It's not just about handing out some food. It's about a relationship.
Right.
And that changes everything.
Right.
So tell me about the army that you've put together that are doing these lunches, that are putting these things together every week. How are you going about all of that?
Yeah. So in the beginning, we started telling our friends and family and they started donating things. But once it grew a little bit bigger and then I made it an official nonprofit, I knew that I was going to need a lot more than what I had available to me at the time. So this was kind of a hard process for me because I was really hesitant about posting on social media. I didn't want it to come across as like, I'm so awesome, I'm doing all this. But we did need the help. So I was like, we have to post because we need the help. So we started posting on social media, and people from all over the community have just stepped up. They sign up to provide the stuff. We, in each lunch, there's a water, juice, a sandwich, either peanut butter and jelly or meat and cheese. There's chips and then a homemade treat. And then we also have, so people sign up to make all of those things, and they're dropped off every week. And then, and that's 100 of those each. And then we also have larger groups like sports teams or small businesses or church groups that want to be a part of it. So then they'll sign up to make like hygiene kits. And then I get to go and speak to them and share with them about our message and what we're doing and thank them, because our donors and our volunteers are the angels. Like, they are what keep us afloat. And I'm so thankful for them, because we wouldn't be able to do this without all of them. But there's hundreds of them. And I just, anytime I have the opportunity to thank them publicly, I do. So thank you. If you're listening and you've donated in some way, anyway, so grateful. And the homies, they feel it. They feel the love that's put into their food. Yeah. And they'd tell me that all the time.
Yeah, no question that it makes all the difference. And this is also a leadership principle. Leaders build an army. And that's literally what you've done. You've invited people to become part of a story. And it's not just a project. It's not just a thing. It is a transformational experience. It's so powerful. So as you look at kind of the takeaways, we always get to the therefore what question. What do you hope people think different? What do you hope they do different as a result of what you're doing with Be a Little Too Kind?
So I feel like the biggest takeaway for me has been accepting the fact that you can't force anybody to change. Be a Little Too Kind isn't out there trying to force homies to make a decision that they're not ready to make mentally. But I do know that through love and kindness and service that's intentional, it has to be intentional, hearts can change. And that's where the magic is. When hearts change, then you start to see a miracle take place, because then people start to realize that they want more for themselves because they deserve more. And they realize their worth. And they stop thinking about who they are currently, and they start thinking about who they want to be. And I just feel really lucky to be in the position that I am in, to be able to sit front row and watch this process unfold for so many homies, a good handful of homies that have like slowly made changes to just completely change their life around. And I just wish that everybody, we'd share every Thursday on our Instagram our stories, but I just wish everybody could see what these small acts of service, even just donating the waters or the chips. Because this whole thing started out as just a small act of kindness anyways. And those small acts of kindness turn into something big. And I just wish everybody knew that. Don't ever think that something that you've done that's so small doesn't matter, because every single person can make a difference.
No small parts or players. The seemingly insignificant often turn into the extraordinary, especially when they're led by a one-of-a-kind leader. And Jessica Lowe, so grateful to have you in studio today. Be a Little Too Kind, bealittletookind.org. Check that out today. And then be part of it. Just live it. If we all do just a little bit, it changes and transforms everything, especially when we do it intentionally and we're looking to build relationships, not just transactions. That's how we make it. And remember, politics may have failed. It's community and culture that lead. It's one family. It's one neighborhood. It's one community coming together in kindness that will actually lead. The politicians will catch up eventually, maybe. All right. Jessica, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
All right, we'll step aside for a quick commercial break. More Inside Sources coming up next on KSL News Radio. Stick around.
Boyd Matheson divides rage from reason on Inside Sources.
Well, we often say on this show that if you really want to fuel freedom anywhere, you unlock and unleash entrepreneurs and small business owners. They drive freedom around the world and right here at home. And far too often, they get overlooked. We always talk about the big Fortune 500 and the big tech companies. But we have to remember that most of those came about because of somebody was an entrepreneur. Somebody was a small business person that had a dream and made that dream a reality, as you can only do here in the United States of America. And one of the important agencies that has a role to play in that, of course, is the Small Business Administration. And we are really pleased to have the Deputy Administrator of the Small Business Administration actually in the state of Utah today, Dilawar Syed. And welcome to the program.
Thank you so much, Bart. Thanks for having me.
So first of all, just tell us a little bit about your role with the Small Business Administration and what it is that we should think about or think differently about when we think about SBA.
Well, I'm, first of all, a tech entrepreneur turned public servant. So I myself have been a small business owner, and it is a privilege of a lifetime to serve at this level as part of the SBA leadership. My role at SBA is to help run the agency. As many small businesses know and many Americans know, this agency really helped sustain our economy during the COVID pandemic, processing almost $1 trillion worth of relief to small businesses to make sure they continue to sustain our economy. In the state of Utah, we have 334,000 small businesses. They are responsible for roughly 1 out of 2 jobs in this great state. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure many of those small businesses were served by SBA during this time. You know, Boyd, at this time in our economic recovery, and we've had a terrific last 3 years of a run on the economic front, we have a huge opportunity for us to see this resurgence of entrepreneurship. And my visit here at the state is to help ensure that all communities, all regions know that there are SBA resources they have access to, whether it's loans and grants and mentorship services to both support new businesses that are being created, but also the ones that need support for the expansion.
Yeah, and such an important thing. I know you're having crucial conversations with the SBA here in the state, as well as with our friends at World Trade Center Utah. And I think that important education process of knowing what's available and how to access the kind of help, I think many, we always say that the small business owners run out of energy before they run out of opportunity. And especially for those maybe in our rural communities who may not think they have access to some of those kinds of things. What's your message to them today?
So first of all, you know, our field office here in Salt Lake City serves the state. And so folks know that they have at no cost access to resources. They should reach out to our local office. If you go to SBA.gov, you can get the address, you can get the phone number and our web presence. And whether you are looking to get advice on your business plan or you're looking to see how you get a loan from a regional bank, there are about 40 plus lenders here that we work with closely. We did north of 1,100 loans last year for a 7A loan. That's working capital loans, roughly $438 million worth of loans that we did in the state of Utah. So again, our teams are ready to assist, to support, and make sure people know how to get access to those financial resources. One of the things that we're feeling that we are very focused on is to ensure that we can encourage more smaller dollar lending. Mm. There's been some reforms that we have done at the agency to make it simpler. So if you're looking for a small loan, let's say $50,000 for your restaurant or to buy a small equipment, we've simplified the process. So our lending partners, the local banks that work with SBA can, incentivize to ensure small dollar lending as well.
Oh, that's fantastic. And it is that smaller, that lower level lending, if you can simplify that process, can make a big difference. As you mentioned, you've been a lifelong tech entrepreneur. You get it. You know you know how this plays out. And especially if you don't have an army of lawyers or lobbyists or people, you need to be able to tap into networks of people and organizations. And obviously, there's a lot of that happening here in the state. Give us a sense in terms of those kinds of resources that people can access really on a wide range. Sometimes we just think it's about a loan, but there's a lot of other services that SBA provides that I think are really crucial to the success of a small business.
Absolutely. Look, in addition to financing, you need mentorship and advice. You need how to grow a business, how to build a business, how to recruit a team. And that's where, again, SBA comes in. We also have a SCORE chapter here in the States where you can get free advice and mentorship from retired executives. I also want to mention that there is an entire innovation grants process with our SBIR, STTR process, which you get non-dilutive grants. There were 29 of these grants that were made available to awardees in the last year. So of course, financing is one aspect, but then also getting mentorship around your business and how to grow a business. How to grow your business abroad. I'm sitting at the World Trade Center right now, and they're a partner for us. to make sure that small businesses who have an exportable product can tap into the global market. And we invest in these local partners here in the state to make sure that, you know, small businesses have access to these local resources as they think about expanding their business in the country, but also abroad.
Fantastic. Yeah, absolutely. That international thing, as we continue to say that Utah is not just a crossroads to the West anymore, it's a crossroads to the world. And finally, I wanted to ask you about your outreach, your help in some of the underrepresented communities when it comes to entrepreneurship and small businesses. What kind of services, what kind of programs and outreach are you and World Trade Center and the local SBA doing in that space?
Absolutely. And that is a huge priority for this administration. You know, equity is at the heart of the president's agenda, President Biden's agenda, and we've been very focused on that. So a couple of things. One, you know, we have to look at the data and see where we are. And we have a lot of work to do, Boyd, when it comes to making sure that all communities have a shot at succeeding in this country when it comes to their entrepreneurial dream. You know, there are 334,000 small businesses in the state, only 142 Black-owned firms that have employees. One in 42 firms. We can do better.
Yeah.
And we have the resources. We are in the right place with investments coming into the country to make sure that, you know, no matter who you are, if you're looking to start a business, you have access to the resources. So one or two areas that I want to highlight here is where we're very focused on ensuring that minority entrepreneurs have access, women entrepreneurs have access to resources, is government contracting. There's a program called 8A program that is designed to support all of these communities. Last year in the state, we did $143 million worth of federal government contracts that were made available to minority entrepreneurs who had a socially disadvantaged past. And that's a program that SBA coordinates. You may know this, the federal government is the world's largest purchaser of goods and services. Right in the state of Utah as well, we have federal government contracts. And we want to make sure that these entrepreneurs have access to them as well to help overcome some of the systemic barriers that some in our minority communities have faced.
Fantastic. Great conversations going on at World Trade Center, Utah, and, of course, the Small Business Administration. Really thrilled to have Deputy Administrator Dilawar Syed joining us on the program. So glad to have you in the state of Utah. We hope this will be the first of many. This is an entrepreneurial state and one that really understands the power, the heartbeat, the drive that comes through our entrepreneurs and small business owners. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Hour number two of Inside Sources coming up after top of the hour news. Stick around.
KSL FM Midvale.
KSL Salt Lake City.
From the KSL Common Spirit Health Studios, this is KSL News Radio.
Utah's news, traffic, and weather station.
Inside Sources.
Inside Sources.
America's voice of reason. Boyd Matheson.
On Utah's home for elevated conversation.
Inside Sources on KSL News Radio.
Well, for months now, the headlines have been around whether or not any kind of foreign aid package would be put together for Ukraine, Israel, Taiwan, Gaza, for some humanitarian aid that's been gummed up and stalled in the House of Representatives. But after the attack by Iran on Israel over the weekend, the equation, the calculus has changed just a little bit. So we want to get underneath those headlines and look at what is it that possibly comes next. Let's begin.
Think you know the news of the day? Think again with Boyd Matheson on KSL News Radio.
Well, as we look at everything unfolding in our nation's capital, of course, there has been the back and forth since the beginning of the year in the new Congress. Actually, it goes back into the previous Congress back in November and December of last year, debating aid to some of our strategic allies and partners, namely Israel, Ukraine, and Taiwan. And then there were some other things floated in there. And of course, inside of the House, there was a demand for border security to be part of that conversation. The Senate passed some things that never caught the light of day in the House. There's a bill sitting there at the moment from the Senate. And the question is, what is the path forward now? Very interesting. Late in the day yesterday, Speaker of the House Mike Johnson unveiled his plan to deal with all of those. And it's a unique strategy. So I want to walk through this a little bit, and we're going to watch this as it continues to unfold and change over the next 24 to 48 hours in terms of who buys in, who opts out, and will the Speaker be able to retain his gavel in the process? So earlier today, the Speaker of the House, Mike Johnson, held a press conference after revealing this plan for foreign aid to many of his Republican colleagues last night. There have been a few of those Republicans who have called on the Speaker to resign. Here was his response to that.
I am not resigning, and it is, in my view, an absurd notion that someone would bring a vacate motion when we are simply here trying to do our jobs.
Speaker also talked about the current moment and how he views himself as a wartime Speaker of the House.
We're in dangerous times, as has been articulated here, around the world, and here at home. We need steady leadership. We need steady hands at the wheel. I regard myself as a wartime speaker. I mean, in a literal sense, we are. I knew that when I took the gavel. I didn't anticipate that this would be an easy path at a difficult time when the nation is terribly divided. The way we get through that is we show unity. And we explain how we have answers to all these great challenges.
So I think that was a good perspective from the Speaker of the House. And it is one of the things in my conversations with the Speaker of the House that this is how he's approaching it. And yeah, there's a lot of chatter going on about some of those in his party who are looking to vacate the chair. Again, that's the way you remove a Speaker of the House. And while there are a few that are rattling those sabers, of course, Marjorie Taylor Greene has filed a motion. You have Representative Massey who's saying he would support it. And what Speaker Johnson is saying is, I'm not concerned about that because we've got important things we have to do on the world stage that are also important to the United States of America and our own interests in areas, in regions, in allies, and our adversaries for that matter. We're going to dig into that a little bit, some of the things that continue to emerge as you look at the connection between Iran and Russia, and then you throw in some of the things that are happening in China as it relates to Taiwan, North Korea, and it's pretty clear that Iran, Russia, China, and North Korea are learning from one another. They're supplying one another with all kinds of things. The drone and missile attack that we saw from Iran directed at Israel, and while all of those were shot down, it really was a pattern. It's exactly what Vladimir Putin has been doing into Ukraine. And how has Vladimir Putin been doing that? He's been doing it with Iranian drones and weaponry. And so there's clearly some collaboration going on between those nations. And so how we support Israel, how we support Ukraine and Taiwan matter. And the Speaker of the House is saying, well, let's do that. And while he didn't bring to the floor the Senate passed bill, he has brought four bills to the floor that would be the blueprint for that. And so that's going to be the interesting thing. There is going to be an amendment process as well. I know that sounds like a radical thing to actually have debate and amendments offered on the floor of the House of Representatives. It just doesn't happen that often anymore, either in the House or the Senate. The leadership tends to figure it all out in advance. They give their members an all or nothing choice. Makes it much easier. No one has to take a hard vote. No one has to deal with any specifics. And everyone moves along their reelection way. And Speaker Johnson is saying, no, let's go at this one piece at a time. Let's look at the aid to Ukraine. Let's look at the aid to Israel. Let's look at the aid to Taiwan. And so a little different from the Senate passed bill, which was a $95 billion foreign aid piece of legislation that put all of those things together, plus a few other things. And while there is some opposition from some of the Republicans in the House, Democrats have expressed a willingness to both vote on those bills, if they do mirror what has come out of the Senate in terms of dollars, and that there is dollars allocated in those bills for some humanitarian relief inside of Gaza for the innocent Palestinians that are suffering there. The Democrats have admitted that they would, if they can look at the legislation, which is coming out now, and see that it is apples to apples, and that it is providing the right kind of aid there, that they would be willing to support that. And many have also indicated that were the motion to vacate the chair, in other words, to get rid of the speaker, executed by either Representative Massey or Representative Greene, that they might be the ones who would be willing to stop that and support the speaker to stay in. Because there are some important things that do need to get done. And if there is another speaker battle in an election year. I think that spells doomsday for the Republicans in terms of maintaining the majority in November. I think it gives the Democrats a great opportunity to retake the House, and then they'll get to choose the Speaker. So that's one of those interesting things that we'll be watching underneath the headlines as well. So all of this is very early in the process in terms of what will actually play out. But those are the components. Of course, there are some in the House that also wanted to have border security as part of these particular packages. I haven't seen anything that has border security in it. Now, my guess is the way Speaker Johnson has teed this up is that that would be possible in an amendment. So that would be interesting to see how that would play out and if that could garner enough Republican and Democratic votes to actually get through and become part of one of those packages. So Speaker of the House Mike Johnson, piecemeal strategy. It's a unique way to go at it. We'll see if he can run the gamut with it and if it allows everyone to move forward in terms of aid to Israel, Ukraine, Taiwan, and humanitarian aid going into Gaza. We'll continue to watch that very close beyond the headlines and the political politics of it all and actually get down to what's the good policy, what's important for the U.S., what's important for our allies, and what messages are we sending to our adversaries around the world. We'll be right back.
Think again on Inside Sources with Boyd Matheson. Get deeper insights on the news from Inside Sources.
We're going to stay with the question just a little bit longer as it relates to some of the foreign aid and defense packages that are working their way, hopefully, onto the floor of the House of Representatives. Of course, Speaker Mike Johnson made the announcement late last night that he would do a series of four pieces of legislation. One for Israel, one for Ukraine, one dealing with Taiwan, and then there's the humanitarian portion dealing with Gaza and some other humanitarian efforts around the world, and that these would be open to some debate and some amendment process. And so we'll see how that continues to play out. But we want to dig into what we're really digesting now in terms of some of the not surprising, somewhat eerie connection points between what's happening in Israel, what Iran is doing and engaging in, and what's happening with Russia and their continued assault on Ukraine. And to help us break all of that down, of course, we always look to Army Colonel retired Jonathan Sweet, served over 30 years as a military intelligence officer, a good friend of the show, a great thinker in all of this. And welcome back to the program.
Hey, Boyd, thanks for bringing me back. I appreciate the opportunity.
All right. So as one of the things that just has been very stunning to me is when you looked at this attack by Iran, the massive swarm of drones followed by the missiles and the longer range missiles, we've seen this somewhere before. It's an area you've been following quite closely in terms of what Russia has been doing every day going into Ukraine. Give us a sense of compare and contrast those strategies and what you're seeing, what you're sensing.
Yeah, absolutely. No, exactly. 300 plus cruise missiles, ballistic missiles and drones thrust upon Israel in a 4 to 5 hour period. And it was in layers, too. It was drones. It was cruise missiles. It was ballistic. It was all timed sequentially to try to provide an overwhelming type of assault on Israel. The Israel's multi-layered defense obviously performed superbly. The interdiction rate was 99%. Which is incredible. But multi-layers, they were attacking, ballistic missiles in the atmosphere. They were attacking cruise missiles, obviously, in the air. They're going after drones. They were getting after it with different weapon systems, the Iron Dome, the David Sling. You saw jet fighters from three different countries that were involved shooting down weapon systems. An integrated air defense has dealt with that massive attack. Ukraine simply doesn't have that. I mean, Ukraine is limited to two or three different weapon systems, and they just don't have the ammunition to save off all the rounds that Russia's overwhelming them with.
Yeah, and so as you look at that, it's to me, it's just ironic that that Iran would use that kind of swarm strategy, and at the same time, Iran is providing a lot of the elements so that Russia can use that same kind of swarm strategy against Ukraine.
Oh, absolutely, and quite frankly, it could overwhelm Ukraine. Look, I mean, Ukraine has weapon systems, but they're now running significantly short on supply of missiles. And the Patriot missile, for example, itself is a $4 million missile. The individual weapon is a $4 million missile, and they're going to use that against hypersonic missiles. They're relying upon smaller systems, Black Hawk, Stingers, Avengers, and in some cases, machine gun fire to shoot the drones down that are coming at them. But it's the volume. It's everything that Russia always do. It's mass. Mass artillery, mass air, mass infantry. That's their tactic, and they're going to continue to use it. And until Ukraine is provided some additional support, they're going to suffer the consequences. Right now, that's their energy structure, infrastructure. But it's also, the last couple months, Russia has hit Kharkiv hard, indicating that Kharkiv is the next ground target that they may be considering in the spring.
Yeah, and I think it's so interesting. I think one of the things that Iran miscalculated was that maybe Israel wasn't as isolated as they thought, that the U.S., the U.K., France, Jordan, Saudi Arabia all came running in support. So I think they underestimated that, and yet when you look to Ukraine, it sure feels like they're kind of standing on their own, and that has to give Vladimir Putin confidence to just keep going at will.
Oh, it certainly does. Ukraine obviously is increasingly isolated, even though the European countries are stepping up, you know, with seven security agreements with seven different nations. Poland and Romania are waiting to sign their agreements. Artillery's coming, and as you said earlier in your segment, you have the Ukraine funding package in Congress, but the lag time from approval to the time which those weapon systems arrive on the battlefield could be weeks or months. So, yeah, they are feeling increasingly isolated, and that does give Putin a window of opportunity. So I suspect you'll probably see more and heavier because he's trying to attrit and degrade confidence and morale within the Ukrainian ranks, but also within the civilian structure.
Yeah, and describe for us just a little bit in terms of, one, how Ukraine is keeping all that together from a military standpoint. And then the longer that goes, where there does start to feel like this inevitability, what that does both inside of Ukraine, but then you have to look at other allies around the world have to be wondering, is the U.S. going to be with them when we say we will?
Absolutely. That's obviously the biggest, from my perspective, national security issue for the United States is losing that confidence in your allies that, one, you're going to sign that agreement, but will you be there when I need you? And will you stay with me to the very end, or will you cut and run? It looks as though increasingly that this administration has a strategy, quite frankly, that is react, defend, contain, and cut and run. You've seen that in Afghanistan. You've seen that in the Sudan. And we're starting to see that, obviously, in Ukraine, but also within Israel, too. Look, the President of the United States just told Prime Minister Netanyahu that we're not going to support an offensive strike against Iran with nothing. It's not like they're going to not provide weapons. They're not going to provide air refuelers. They're not going to provide intelligence. They're not going to provide weapon systems. That's a strong message. And you got to sit back and wonder, am I next? What does Taiwan think? You know, what does the Eastern European countries there in NATO, how are they perceiving this? So, no, it does do a lot of harm to the United States that we, for the last 6 months almost, have been virtually absent without leave.
Yeah, and give me a sense of what you're watching for in the days ahead, both inside of Ukraine in terms of their ability to continue to hold the line and in terms of Israel and what they choose to do or not do moving forward.
Yeah, so within Ukraine, I think you're going to continue to see this mobile defense that they've established within the Donbas. And it's very effective. I mean, they're seeding terrain, don't get me wrong, but on the score and the level of Russian soldiers that they're killing each day, estimated by the British intelligence to be about 750 to 1,000 a day, not to mention the number of tanks and artillery and BMPs. So for them, the close fight is the fight, in addition to some of the deeper strikes that they're doing against oil refineries, trying to stop, if you will, the funding of the Russian war. What they're missing, obviously, is the ability to interdict, the ability to stop the forces before they arrive in Ukraine, as opposed to actually fighting them from the foxhole. So that's one. So in Iran, I think, or in Israel, I think what you're going to see within the next, you know, week probably is Iran's looking really hard at what they're going to target. The most immediate threat to Iran right now is the IRGC. And they have gone after IRGC leadership throughout December. I mean, they hit them in Syria, in Damascus, Syria, and are also recently obviously blew up the consulate. But that's a threat. So I suspect you may see IRGC formations, bases, ammunition storage facilities. I think you're going to see them going after their ability to fund a war, see oil platforms and pipelines. I think you're also going to see them go after the nuclear facilities because that is the most dangerous threat to them. Yeah. And Iran, clearly within the next week, month, 2 months, can produce a nuclear weapon. Now, can they operationalize it? That's a different story. But they can make a nuclear weapon, and that's a threat. And they will go after that. And the last thing they may go after, and this takes up the step on the escalation ladder, the last step is going after actual regime leadership, all within a possible reality. Yep.
Wow. It is a turbulent time, to say the least. This is a time for real leadership, and often that can be unpopular within your own political party. But it's the kind of leaders that we've seen in the past in this country. It's the kind of leadership we've got to have today as well. Retired Army Colonel Jonathan Sweet, as always, love your perspective. Thanks for walking us through and connecting the dots. And I think those dots are fascinating between Iran, Russia, China, and North Korea. We've got to keep our eye on all of that as well. Thanks so much. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks. Once again, thanks for having me on board. Appreciate it.
All right. We'll step aside for some bottom of the hour news. When we come back, more Inside Sources coming up next on KSL News Radio. Stick around.
Inside Sources.
Inside Sources.
America's voice of reason. Boyd Matheson.
On Utah's home for elevated conversation.
Inside Sources on KSL News Radio.
Well, as the election season continues to heat up and hyperventilate, we are stuck once again with a whole lot of finger pointing, a good bit of slander, and some just plain old bad behavior. In a perfect world, of course, we wouldn't have to deal with misinformation or disinformation, whether that's coming from people who occupy high office or who are part of institutions that should have high trust. So the question is, how do we cope with what is sadly becoming entrenched as the new political norm? Well, someone who's been thinking about that and writing about that, Stephen Greenhut, of course, a friend of the show, Western Region Director for the R Street Institute, previously the Union Tribune California columnist based there in Sacramento. And Stephen, welcome back to the show.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
You have a fantastic piece, which is often we see this kind of thing where we get the misinformation, disinformation, things that challenge free speech. And of course, we have that natural response to regulate it through government. Walk us through your piece in terms of what we should be talking about, what we should be thinking about, and while combating disinformation and misinformation is good, the laws aren't going to cut it.
Yeah, it's, you know, it's one of these things that keeps coming up, these discussions. You know, I guess misinformation is just wrong information. Disinformation is maliciously wrong information. But we're the people, I guess, who are promoting it know that it's not correct and are just trying to, I don't know, do a psyops or whatever they're trying to do to influence people. The problem that I heard from readers was that they're like, yeah, look, good piece. What do we do about it? And the problem, I guess I'll start with the easy part, which is the problem, is we have this, nobody seems to be able to even agree on what the basic sets of facts are.
Yeah.
It seems prevalent, especially with social media. I keyed off on Donald Trump, who I'm not a fan, but, you know, whatever. Some of his allegations have certainly thrown the mainstream media into a tizzy. Those of us who write for newspapers, it's hard to know how to deal with it. So it's a brave new world. And so what I focused on was what we ought not to do, which is always, the easiest part when you're a writer is what not to do. And I see a lot of folks, especially on the left, they want to combat Donald Trump by creating some sort of panels to analyze information and determine what's true. And it's real easy to see where that goes, right? I mean, I use the example of climate change. So a lot of people on the left, they believe it's as true as gravity. So if we have government determining what's appropriate speech on that in that area, we're going to just silence all sorts of dissenting voices. We're not going to have new studies and new information comes out that challenges the accepted wisdom. And that's never a good idea from a you know, learning and growing perspective. It's also an assault on the First Amendment. And there have been folks, you know, some academics and folks on the left who have actually said, I quoted a New York Times piece, that we need to rethink how the First Amendment is interpreted. I'm like, no, we don't need to rethink how it's interpreted. I like it just fine. People get to say what they want. We have libel laws to deal with in a civil way with, you know, with that sort of problem. That's not going to help. That's only going to make it worse. It's only going to breed more distrust, as we've seen, even when the private social media companies have tried to limit speech or put their own spin on what's true, what's information, what's disinformation. So that's just no good. I mean, that's just a bad way to go.
Yeah. And so as you look at that, the one of the quotes you had in there from that same New York Times piece was that they're looking at the First Amendment as just being inadequate for our era. And then I want you to talk through and unpack for just a second this fixation we seem to be getting into in the country, that if we have a problem, that there's got to be a government solution to this of some sort, and that changing laws will change the outcomes. And you say we've got to change the norms before we can ever deal with any kind of changing of the law.
Yeah, I mean, this is really a norm problem, right? Because we can't, if you and I totally disagree, if I say the sky's blue and you say it's green, we can't have somebody try to determine that. A third party in government is never a neutral party. It's a party backed by force. And I get tired. I mean, I get tired of people with there ought to be a law syndrome, where any problem, there's got to be a government solution, a law. As a free market guy, I believe that most things ought to be hammered out and within, social context, within the private sector. The problem is, you know, we have a problem where people just can't even agree on the facts, as I mentioned before, and that's a norm problem. There's no easy solution here other than more good information. You know, you could just speak the truth as we see it and as much as we can. I mean, I just don't see that there's any super easy fix to it. And part of it is the politicization of everything. And I think people often embrace ideas that don't seem factual or true based on an ideology that they've embraced. And I see it on both sides of the spectrum, really. Yeah. Some of the crazy discussions I have on X with people on the far left and the far right, and I just can't even believe that people are taking the positions that they're taking. I don't know what you do other than you just keep disseminating facts as we see it and hope that it sticks. I don't know what else to do.
Yeah, well, it is. I think it's that better information and better discourse that you pointed out in your piece as well. I think it's also getting to those norms of that cosmic perspective of staying a little bit humble, that you might actually be wrong about something. It's about being radically curious in terms of, you know, why does she think that's a good way to solve that problem? Or why does he think this particular policy will actually produce a better outcome? But having those kinds of conversations, that kind of information, that kind of discourse, I think is at least the beginning of the beginning of a path. But the more laws and less free speech is rarely going to lead us to anywhere that's going to be meaningful. Stephen Greenhouse, the Western Region Director for the R Street Institute. And Stephen, great to have you back on the show. Great perspective. Great piece, as always. Thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
All right. Again, that's Stephen Greenhut from Sacramento, Western Region Director for the R Street Institute. And we do have this knee-jerk reaction kind of thing that a lot of times when we want to change outcomes, I love the way Stephen said it. How many times have you said, well, there ought to be a law against, or there ought to be a law for, or we ought to write somebody about that? And while we can be curious and we can go about that, we need to make sure we stop. And before we immediately abdicate our own thinking to government, we got to just think. And then we got to think with each other and have that exchange of ideas and information, have a higher level discussion. Because if we do that, I have great confidence in the American people. We can get to the right solutions. And government has a role to play, but we have to be very careful, especially when we're doing something like combating disinformation. It's getting to the better norms, not more laws, that's going to get us to the better result. All right, we'll step aside for one last break. Some final thoughts coming up on Inside Sources coming up next here on KSL News Radio. Stick around. We'll be right back.
Hear elevated conversation on crucial issues. Boyd Matheson on Inside Sources.
Welcome back to Inside Sources here on KSL News Radio. It's great to be with you today, as always. I am Boyd Matheson, and as we round out the program today, if you missed anything, of course, you want to go back to the KSL podcast and check out Inside Sources. You can go back to any of our conversations. They're all there, easy to access, and all the things you can get to in terms of the principles, the policies, the ideas that we explored during the course of the show. And one you're going to want to go back and listen to for sure today is our conversation with Jessica Lowe from BeALittleTooKind.org, who is just doing some amazing things. It just started out with someone who was taking culinary classes and recognizing that they were throwing away a lot of food at the end, and then finding a way to share that with those that are experiencing homelessness. And it has branched into a nonprofit. They're just doing some amazing things. They were all part of One Kind Act, the summit that was held last Friday, of course, with the help of Khosrow Simnani and the Simnani Family Foundation. And we're going to continue to highlight some of those extraordinary individuals who are doing what we talk about every day on this show. Do something that makes a difference. And it can be as simple as recognizing, wow, there's some extra food there. We could probably get that to somebody who really needs it, and it might make a difference. And then you build on that and go beyond that. And Jessica Lowe's done an extraordinary job of turning this in not to just a food transaction, but the building of relationships that's transforming lives. It makes all the difference. And we're going to continue to have those conversations on this show because that's what we do. In the context of looking at what's happening in society, what principles are driving real progress. And, of course, we'll look at that in the context of what's happening politically and geopolitically around the world. And all of those things are interconnected. But ultimately, it gets down to principles and people. And that's where we always start, and that's where we always want to end the program here on Inside Sources. And one of the interesting things that I've been noodling on the last couple of days, of course, with tax day and finances and retirement planning, all of those things. We all know that money compounds, and I think we get that. We understand that. We know it compounds when we're paying interest. We all feel that. If you've got a car loan or a credit card bill that you're carrying a balance on, you get that interest never sleeps. It's always working. It's always adding up. Of course, we often talk about the $34 trillion of national debt that we're facing and the interest payments on that. Compound interest is a big deal. It will be one of the largest budget items in the whole country, in all of our government. One of the largest things that's going to have to be allocated every year moving forward is our interest payment on the loan. And just recognize that that compound interest can't be spent on it, and it doesn't produce anything. It doesn't give you a new Navy or a fleet or weapons. It doesn't give you a new shelter for the homeless. It doesn't give you a new school. It doesn't even fill a pothole. It's just interest that has to be paid. So it compounds. And I want to flip the script on that a little bit and get to something else that compounds that we don't talk about near enough. And that's knowledge and habits. Knowledge and habits compound over time. And so, of course, every financial expert is going to preach about the power and importance of being on the positive side of compound interest. Again, you don't want to be on the paying side, especially if you've racked up $34 trillion in debt. But you also have to look at the fact that fortunes are made on the momentum of even small and simple compound interest. People who maybe not have one of the lifestyles of the rich and famous, but who just understood compound interest and invested wisely and saved smartly over time can make all the difference. So the same thing is true when it comes to knowledge, to learning, to good habits. There's a great compounding effect that can really change your present. It can change the future for sure. So knowledge is compounded when it's internalized. I believe it was Oliver Wendell Holmes said that a mind once expanded by knowledge can never return to its original size. And to me, that's one of the things that we should be doing every day in our K-12 and on every college campus in the country, is creating space for that expansion of knowledge, because it is true that a mind once expanded doesn't go back to that same size and shape. So the compounding effect comes as new knowledge leads to new thoughts. That leads to new insight. That leads to new inspiration. And one simple piece of knowledge can be the catalyst for a host of all kinds of innovative ideas, an expanded vision of what's possible. I actually spent some time this morning with some students who are real entrepreneurs from American Fork High School and a couple of other surrounding schools as they got together in a kind of a speed dating experience with some mentors. And I'm amazed. I mean, so these kids were running businesses, starting marketing firms, doing things on social media, running a landscaping business, car detailing, all kinds of interesting things. But they were individuals who had had their mind expanded by an extraordinary teacher. And now they're continuing to add to that knowledge. And then they keep expanding. And then they teach and share. And then things just keep going. That's how it works. And the same thing is true with habits. A new bad habit can trigger an avalanche of negative behaviors that can wipe you out individually, collectively, as an organization. And the same thing can happen when you have momentum created by a very small, maybe insignificant habit that can really change your course. So trying to do that individually and as society, that's the challenge. And good leaders recognize that that's how you do it. It's one small habit. It's one little piece of knowledge at a time. And it has to go beyond what we tend to see in national media and a lot of the national political issues. It's either misinformation or disinformation. And it all is centered around this idea of controlling the narrative and controlling the flow of the conversations. And that's where we the people have to step up and step in. It's not going to be government mandating it. It's not going to be government controlling it or divvying it out to us. We have to be the ones who go after knowledge. We're the ones who have to find the truth and be the truth, speak the truth, and then have conversations where we're radically curious, where we can think different, we can learn something new, we can admit, wow, maybe I had that wrong. Or my favorite thing that we get to do every day on this show is say, wow, I'd never thought of it that way. Well, we hope you did that today on a host of things, from what's happening across the planet and what's happening right here in our own backyard. I'm Boyd Mathison. Thanks for joining us on Inside Sources today. And as always, as you go out into the world today, make sure you see something that inspires, say something that uplifts, and yes, do something that makes a difference.
KSL FM Midvale.
KSL Salt Lake City.
From the KSL Common Spirit Health Studios, this is KSL News Radio.
Utah's news, traffic, and weather station.